Is your name tag? Okay. Good morning, everyone. So maybe just some admin talk. As you all have noticed, we're running about 20 or 25 minutes late. I'm told we can run over for that 20 minutes for this session, and some of the time will be made up through lunch or through some of the transfer times and so forth, but we'll see. We might be able to save some time here as well. So just to confirm, the session you are attending today is the life as amended arbitration and the actuarial quantification of constitutional damages. My name is Wim Loertz, and I'm the chairman of the ASSA Damages and Compensation Committee. Our speaker today is Mr. Greg Whittaker. So Greg is also sitting on the Damages Committee. He's a fellow of the South African Society of Actuaries and also of the American Society of Actuaries. He's a well-known practitioner in the damages space. He's got over 20 years' experience. For the last 12 years or so, he's been running his own practice. He's also a trained mediator, and he currently also serves as trustee to the Actuarial Society Education Trust. So I'd like to welcome Greg and thank him for the paper. I just want to confirm that there is actually a formal paper that was written. There's a slight error on the convention program. There's a P to the next to the one session preceding this one, but it should actually be in alignment with this one. So there is a formal paper for those of you that are interested in reading up a bit more. So I'd like to hand over to Greg now. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Wim, and thanks for everyone that's come to attend. Okay, to start, if we turn back the clock 366 days ago, if you were in Johannesburg at the Parktown Emoyeni Conference Center, there was an arbitration underway, and we were listening on that day to the testimony of three people who had lost loved ones. The first person that gave testimony that day was Lucas Mukhwane. His brother Christopher had been at Life Esidimeni facilities for 30 years, and following the transfer out of those facilities, he died within a month. Similarly, the testimony of Lusibe Lekhwabe, his brother Motefele, had been at Life Esidimeni for 33 years, and he died within 2 months of being transferred out of that facility. The last person to give testimony that day, and it was actually being televised, the entire hearings were televised on SABC News and also on EWN. The last person to give evidence that day was Ntombifuthi Dadla. Her brother had died within a month of being transferred, and following a lengthy search for his body, she finally had to go and identify his decayed corpse. How did we get here? So just a brief description. Life Esidimeni is a private facility that the Gauteng Department of Health were subsidizing to take care of psychiatric patients. It was almost a sort of evergreen contract that had been in force for quite a few years, in fact, decades. And in around about June 2015, there was a rumor that that contract was going to be cancelled. So the South African Society of Psychiatrists warned of the likely consequences of suddenly moving people that had been at facilities for an extended period of time. And they just warned against this before October 2015, when the then Gauteng Head of Health, or the MEC for Health, Kidani Mashlangu, announced that they were going to cancel the contract. So between October 2015 and June 2016, there was a mass transfer of mental health care users out of various Life Esidimeni facilities in Gauteng. The bulk of the transfers occurred between April and June 2016. In many cases, family members weren't even informed that they were moving their loved ones, and by July 2016, families started to ask questions: "Where are my family member?" In August 2016, one of the Christine Gumalu, she found out about the death of her sister, and when she started to investigate at this particular NGO that she'd been transferred to, she discovered that 8 other patients had died. And then things started escalating from there. By September 2016, following questions from in the Gauteng provincial government, the MEC announced that there'd been 36 deaths following the transfer of out-of-life esidimeni facilities. The health minister immediately requested the health umber to investigate, and by January 2017 he had compiled his report and asked the MEC for health whether she would like to make any submissions. She asked for an extension, and then the final report was released in on the 1st of February 2017. On the release of the report, the MEC for health resigned. So the report of the health umbert was the report into the circumstances surrounding the deaths of mentally ill patients in the Gauteng province. And there were a few major findings that the health umbert made. Firstly, between March 2016 and December 2016, there were actually 94 deaths, not 36, as the MEC for Health reported. All these people had been moved out of the Life Esidimeni facility to non-government organizations, and all 27 of the NGOs which they were transferred actually operated under invalid licenses. So they were basically, to a large extent, a lot of these places were just sort of residential homes, and all of a sudden were turned into an NGO so that they could get a subsidy from the Gauteng Department of Health to look after mentally ill patients. The health umbert found that the mental health care users died under unlawful circumstances, that the Gauteng Department of Health decision to transfer them was unwise and flawed, and that there was inadequate planning, and that the entire process was just chaotic and rushed. What happened in some instances, buckies would arrive at the middle of the night, just take mental health care users out of Life Esidimeni. They'd literally just tie them to the back of a bucky and ship them off to an NGO. And that's the kind of thing that was happening. So following that, the health umbert, he made a number of recommendations, the most important one of which was recommendation 17, that an alternative dispute resolution process be established. And the whole idea behind this process was to determine mechanisms of redress and compensation for affected family. So prior to the commencement of the arbitration, the state made certain admissions. So they admitted liability. They said we are guilty. However, and they also agreed to pay some sort of compensation. So they said that they agreed to pay compensation to the mental health care users, either to individual families or as a group. And they tendered an amount of 200,000 Rand for funeral expenses and general damages under the common law, which I'll get to a bit later. The core dispute that the arbitration dealt with was what is the nature and the extent of equitable redress for affected families. Here, the claimants sought constitutional damages, and it's a head of damages which the state strenuously resisted. They said they weren't liable for constitutional damages. These people can be compensated under the South African common law. So just to give you, those who don't know, the common law is basically a law of precedent. So you basically build on previous decisions. For example, if there's a judgment that says the retirement age for a teacher is 65 in a damages calculation, then you'll use that as the retirement age for future cases. So there's a whole body of common law which basically is the way our law gets developed. So if we turn to what are the damages available on unlawful death? So you have there's common law claims. So there's three main heads of damages can be claimed there. Funeral expenses, And then you can get general damages for emotional shock, so that often then you need to have expert evidence to show that there is a link between the death and the award for general damage. So basically, a common one there is if somebody is a passenger and the driver gets killed and they witness that happening, you often can get a claim for general damages arising. And then the third one is a claim for loss of support. So that's invariably the largest part of a compensation claim. And there you get an amount that's linked to what the deceased was earning. So there's normally an actuarial calculation that flows from the third item, where you will calculate a normal loss of support claim, where you normally project the deceased's earnings, and then you allocate a portion of the earnings to the dependents, and then calculate the capitalized value thereof. So that's normally the bulk of the claim in unlawful death matters, but it did not exist in this matter because all of the deceased were long-term mental health care users. They weren't employed, and they were never going to become employed. In actual fact, the range of ages of the people that died ranged from the age of 21 to 103. So the thing to turn to then is, well, constitutional damages. So there, a court can fashion a new remedy as appropriate relief. So you'll look to constitutional damages where the common law doesn't really cater for any other loss. So Section 38 of the Constitution, it basically talks about the right to approach a court for appropriate relief if a right in the Bill of Rights has been infringed or threatened. So appropriate relief can take many forms, such as just an apology, and it can also take on the form of actual compensation. To give you some of the examples of the infringements of the Constitution that were mentioned by the arbitrator in the final award, there was insufficient rotten or no food at some of the NGOs, so some people just merely died of starvation. People died of dehydration. They didn't have clean water at some of the facilities. Some people were transferred without even as much as an ID document, let alone what medication they're taking. So they were denied access to medicine. In some cases, people died as a result of not having access to the regular medicine that they're receiving at Life Esidimeni. Some of the mental health care users were tortured, abused. There was insufficient bedding and blankets, and some died from exposure to cold. A lot of the transfers occurred during the period from April. The bulk of the transfers sort of occurred during winter in Gauteng from April to June 2016. There was abuse and a report of a rape at one of the facilities. And there was even denial of dignity and death. I mean, some bodies were just stacked up in an old butchery, not being kept at the right temperature. Some were decayed beyond even being able to extract a fingerprint to identify the deceased. So the scale of infringements was just, you just can't believe it's happened in this day and age. So how does South African case law help us regarding constitutional damages? Well, there's a well-known case of FOES, which basically dealt with, it was basically a police brutality matter. In that particular matter, the court ruled that the common law was broad enough in many cases to deal with the damages suffered. So in that particular matter, the person that was the victim was compensated for loss of earnings, for general damages, and so on. So there wasn't, they received the full extent of their damages, and they were placed in the same position as they would have been had the assault not occurred. But the Constitutional Court in that matter, they did expand it, but they said appropriate relief must mean effective relief. So the reason for that is, where so few people in South Africa have access to or the means to enforce their rights, there needs to be another layer of protection. And in this regard, courts need to forge new tools so as to assist people in these circumstances. So The matter of Foz just gave us some broad constitutional considerations, but then in terms of South African case law, there's only been two matters where standalone constitutional damages have been awarded. The first case was the matter of Kate, which was a matter back, dating back to the 1990s, where a lady applied for a social grant in, I think it was in 1996, and they took 3 years to finally give her access to the grant due to just maladministration. And the court awarded constitutional damages there equal to the interest that she would have earned on the social grant had she received it in 1996. In reality, as the court mentioned, she wouldn't really have suffered any loss because she would have just because she was in such dire circumstances, she would have just consumed the grant and would never have invested it. But they said they came up with this concept of, well, her loss is just as real as someone who could have invested the grant. They also mentioned in that matter that there wasn't any empirical monetary standard against which to measure the loss. So it also sort of opened the way for us, where we have no, in our particular matter, where there was no real common law claim for loss of support, to just come up with some other way of finding compensation. The only other matter on constitutional damages was the Mordeklip matter, which involved the unlawful occupation of a farm in the Davidson-Benoni area. It was again a very lengthy matter where the owners of the farm repeatedly tried to go through the correct channels to get the unlawful occupants off the land. There were numerous rounds of court cases, all during which the number of people that occupied the farm just grew. It started off at like 400 and ended up at 15,000 by the time the final round of litigation was over. So there was just another illustration of just how slow the law was moving. But a very important thing, a takeaway from the matter, is just the persistency of the complainant. And the same holds for the families of the victims in this matter. There were some controversial comments made by certain politicians about why should these people get compensated? They didn't even care for their loved ones. Well, to the contrary, in this particular matter, the people that were compensated were the people that formed family. There was a family organization that there were a number of parties involved. They can definitely not be accused of doing nothing. They tried all channels down to the courts, which even denied them. So South African case law, there's only two cases on constitutional damages. If we turn to international case law, we'd look at first North America. In America, obviously, we don't have punitive damages in South Africa. So in America, they do. So they're punitive damages are really a punishment or deterrent. It's often, well, completely unrelated to the actual loss incurred. There's quite a big body of case law on nursing home abuse in America. In actual fact, I mean, there's attorneys that even specialize in just nursing home abuse cases. And in two of the bigger matters, there was a matter of Nunziata, where it was a 92-year-old lady that was... she was left alone by a nursing staff while they took a smoke break, and then she fell downstairs and died. And then the matter of Jackson, that was awarded $100 million to the estate. That was also a matter where the patient was abused by nursing staff. The only takeaway from, because we don't, our law is not developed to the stage of punitive damages and unlikely to ever be so, is just the seriousness with which they view those types of offences. There was a matter in Canada, the matter of Ward. A brief description of that matter: basically, somebody that was attending a presidential talk, and there were rumours that he was actually going to throw a pie at the Prime Minister, but he was incorrectly identified, arrested, and that led to the first award for constitutional damages in Canada. Canada is not like America. They're more sort of Commonwealth-based legal system. So they just said vindication and deterrence should support the compensatory function, unlike America, where it's more vindication. They also, one of the principles, they also said that damages must be appropriate and just to the claimant and the state. So we were obviously cognizant of the fact that whatever sort of figure we came up in our matter, that's going to have an effect on the overall healthcare expenditure for the Gauteng Department of Health. So why we can't sort of come up with a number that's going to be more than what the healthcare department would have spent on these people anyway. So that was something in the back of our minds, and that was at least set down in this, you know, that principle was at least enunciated in this case. If you look at international case law in the Commonwealth, a lot of these matters relate to the torture or abuse of prisoners. So I'm not going to go through the details of each case, but other than we're just going to look at some of the principles that come out of those matters. In New Zealand, the matter of Tanawa, they sort of say that there's a relationship between vindication and compensation. So basically, if the amount to vindicate is more than the ordinary compensation, then and you also need to do another sum looking at what's the amount of compensation versus how much would it take to vindicate the matter. You don't want one being more than, well, we don't want a situation of double counting where you sort of pay 200,000 rand in or $200,000 in compensation when the ordinary award would have just been, say, $100,000. So they're very careful not to pay more than what can be afforded. In that matter also, they said it would be astonishing if the circumstances in that case were to ever occur again. You can read more about the detail in the paper. I won't go and don't have time to sort of run through the details of every single case. But the purpose of these cases is just to sort of point out some of the guiding principles that we used when we started looking at this case. In the matter of Ramanoop in Trinidad and Tobago, the violation of the constitution, the violation of the constitutional right, adds an extra dimension to the wrong. Was the finding. And also that matter, just like this one, was basically representative of an arbitrary abuse of state power. So a common refrain throughout the hearing from various health officials was, well, I didn't know that this was going to lead to deaths. We took a collective decision, the usual sort of stuff, nobody taking responsibility in terms of which is actually, I mean, administrative law is a major subsection which was just ignored by the various officials. An answer of "I didn't know" just doesn't hold water when you are the minister of health in a province as big as Gauteng. In the United Kingdom, also the one of the matters of Rooks, they also said the defendant shouldn't be asked to pay more than what they're able to pay. So there are financial constraints under which the award would have been made. So a lot of the argument from the defence in the Isidimeni matter was, well, state, you're diverting funds from the state spend on healthcare, and we just can't afford this. We also looked into torture legislation. So there are various standalone legislation regarding torture in Africa, some countries. South Africa has a Prevention and Combating of Torture of Persons Act. So there's, however, that act doesn't expressly deal with compensation for loss of support. It's basically just based on, it just incorporates the UN Convention against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman or Degrading Treatment or Punishment. So it just basically just echoes that UN Convention, which basically just says that there needs to be some compensation for victims of torture. They don't set out exactly what that compensation should be or how it's to be calculated. So South Africa does have a standalone act. A lot of countries just merely rely on the UN Convention. Uganda does have a standalone act. They provide for economically assessable damages, such as lost opportunities. They apply for provide for rehabilitation and restitution. So it includes payment for harm or loss suffered. So some countries have developed more specific things under which that you can get compensated. If one looks at torture legislation in Asia, there's various countries that do have standalone acts. The Maldives, they allow for economic and non-economic compensation. The Philippines, all victims of torture have a right to claim compensation, and they've got a minimum of 10,000 pesos as an award, but that's not a particularly high amount. And then Nepal's got quite an advanced advanced torture legislation, where they look at a variety of aspects under which you can get compensated, physical and mental pain suffered. They look at they relate the losses to the earning capacity and the expense of treatment. And then in the case of death, interestingly enough, they look at the minimum amount for the dependent's livelihood, and there they don't rely on whether the person's working or not. So that was a good pointer for us, because we have a whole body of deceased, none of which were employed. So there we could say, well, hang on, we could start looking at perhaps living expenses. What's the minimum amount? So actuarial involvement, how does it come about? There's a well-known matter, appeal court matter of Southern Assurance versus Bailey, where the judge talks about two approaches to granting compensation. The one is that a judge can just use their gut feel, just sort of thumb suck a number and off you go. The other one is to look at mathematical calculations, which are on a more logical basis. And what really paved the way for actuaries in the damages space to a large extent was this particular judgment, where this is the reason why the courts prefer actuarial calculations in support of damages claims. So in assessing constitutional damages, it's obviously not a straightforward loss of earnings calculation, as I explained, but I had an approach from Section 27, which was one of the it's a non-profit legal group that was defending many of the taking care of many of the families of the deceased, and they came to see me in about 2016, and they said, well, how can we go about assessing compensation for these people? The families didn't really want to present a thumbsuck figure when they went to arbitration, but we also knew whatever compensation was going to be awarded would have to be rooted in the constitutional values of equity and fairness. A starting point we used for the calculations, what's the cost to maintain the mental health care users at life instead of any? In other words, pretty much tantamount to their living expenses. One can draw a parallel to other aspects of law where sometimes actuaries are asked to work on matters where referred to as wrongful birth matters, where there's a failed sterilization and then a further child is born, and then the parents claim damages for the cost of living of that unwanted child. In that sort of case, an actuary would just value the future living expenses of the child, and we thought, well, there is some sort of parallel to be drawn with mental health care users, where we know what their living expenses are. And we just thought, well, if you apply a common law principle, you normally always put the claimant in the same position as they would have been had the death not occurred. We can just flip that around and put the state in the same financial position as they would have been had the unlawful deaths not occurred. So in other words, what we were thinking of there is that these unlawful deaths basically resulted in an unlawful saving to the state. So that formed a good starting point for the calculations. We got quite a lot of data from Section 27, so we had details on the number of. Another thing that came out, and it's probably true of most government departments, those of us who do work for like Wim and I, like the state attorney, etc., often the data is really poor quality, and there was no difference in this matter where we were like wholly reliant on Section 27 to get us all the dates of birth, but even so, like five were missing, so we had to make some assumptions. As I mentioned earlier, like the oldest person to, it's almost unconscionable, but the oldest person to die and that was transferred all of a sudden was 103 years old. Unfathomable how you could do that. But the subsidy paid by the Gauteng Department of Health in respect of the mental health care users was 320 rand per patient per day. That was in the 2015 financial year, and we just projected that per deceased. We had to get a handle on just the mortality of psychiatric patients, but to start with, we just wanted some other underlying mortality table. We looked at a few sources, the 84-86 table, that is the last full life table, and still used quite extensively in damages claims today. And it's the argument there is it's one of the first tables it's the last table sort of pre-HIV/AIDS. But we thought that given the nature of the underlying population, one would have to make some provision for HIV/AIDS mortality. So there were three different sources. We looked at the Rapid Mortality Surveillance Report, the Statistics South Africa Mid-Year Estimates, and then we looked at the Tembisa model. So we ended up using the Tembisa model projected to 2016. As our sort of like underlying mortality table. Then we didn't have details of each of the conditions that each of the deceased had. So like, you know, there were a mixture of patients, some were bipolar, some were schizophrenic, etc. So there was a whole mix, but we just, because there was just such a lack of record keeping across the board. Like we didn't even know what the diagnosis for some of these people were, so we couldn't really do it on an individual basis. And we thought, well, it's better to just look at an aggregate sort of mortality basis. And the first study that we looked at, there's only been one paper on the mortality of psychiatric patients in South Africa. It was the Kamka study. But that paper wasn't really useful because the subsidy that it's based at Best Corpies. The subsidy that they receive is significantly higher than the subsidy at that Life is Dimini were receiving. So we couldn't really use that. And also that paper found that the standardized mortality ratios weren't statistically significant, but I think that was really as a result of, they were comparing it to a fairly heavy table of mortality at that stage. It was a paper in the 90s when estimates of the impact of HIV/AIDS were much higher than what they are now. We probably couldn't have done anything had it not been for the CEO of Life is Dimini, who in a media report mentioned how many deaths had occurred at their facilities prior to this mass transfer. So from October 2011 to September 2015, we had an idea of how many deaths there were, and we related that to the Life Care Annual Health Reports, and we were able to just derive a fairly rough mortality ratio for various occupancy rates. We also just ran through some of the international studies on psychiatric disorders. Those of you in insurance will know Breckenridge's Medical Section of Life Risk, so it was a pretty useful reference. But again, all of these sort of things only take you so far because we didn't have a diagnosis per patient. So we just went with a extra mortality loading and did a sort of aggregate calculation. Just running through, the last ingredient was just the net discount rate to apply just to calculate the capitalized values. We looked at We sort of systematically went through various things, such as, well, we don't have a legislated net discount rate in South Africa. There's no fixed rules. Every case really depends on the evidence before it. Recent case law discount rates have ranged between minus 0.3 to 3%. We did a survey in 2015 of practitioners, about 20 actuaries in the damages space, which is pretty much everybody. Was about using an average discount rate of about 1.75 for medical expenses. We looked at other areas such as the Pension Funds Act, where there are discount rates that are, you know, pre-retirement discount rates as legislated, and at least that gave us a good feel. We just looked at other countries. The UK, they sort of mandate a minus 0.75 discount rate. America's pretty much similar to South Africa, where you generally look at the evidence in each case. So they often rely on economists to get evidence. Canada has numerous, each province has a different net discount rate, ranging from 0 to 3%. Australia is the anomaly. They mandate extremely high discount rates for damages claims, ranging from 5 to 8%. But they do that just for what they claim sustainability purposes. Hong Kong has a graduated sort of net discount rate ranging from, I think it's 0% for the first 5 years, going up to 2.5%. And Bermuda also has a negative discount rate for damages claims. We decided to just go with, we showed a whole range of discount rates ranging from like 1.5 to 2.5. And we also showed the impact of various mortality loadings. From our analysis of the extra mortality at life to many facilities, the middle column was the most appropriate, with a loading of 120%. So in terms of the group of people that we had, there was about the average age was of the order in the 50s, and the normal life expectancy of the group would have been about 21 years, and our loading resulted in roughly a 7-year reduction in life expectancy. So we were quite comfortable with that, and our sort of average figure at a net discount rate of 2.5 was basically an average. The government would have paid roughly $1.5 million per deceased had they not died. Just to quickly run through the arbitration proceedings, the Section 27. It was a bit of a different compared to your normal matter in court, where there's normally just a plaintiff and defendant. In this case, there are a number of parties that were being represented. So Section 27 represented 63 of the deceased. Her special attorneys represented four claimants, and those four claimants were actually moved out of a NGO to make way for the other people that had been transferred from Life is a Many and then died. And then Legal Aid South Africa represented some of the survivors, and then the defendant or the state was represented by Worksman's attorneys. And then the arbitrator was the former Deputy Chief Justice of South Africa, Justice Dikam Mosoneke. The arbitration proceedings ran for 45 days altogether. 60 witnesses took to the stand. I gave evidence on the 30th of November last year. And then on the 19th of March, the government was ordered to pay R1 million to each of the claimants in constitutional damages. So the question is, well, have they ever paid the money? Well, they actually did. In June, they paid the money. So they paid R159 million in damages to the claimants in respect of this action. But I believe now there's about another 200 claimants that are coming forward. We did all of this work on a pro bono basis. Because I've had a fairly long-standing relationship with Section 27, so we've helped them on quite a few matters over the years. And, just sometimes you just feel something like this you just can't charge for. It's important to do pro bono work as actuaries. I think without experts, really, public impact litigation can come to a halt. Attorneys that are working in these various NGOs, such as Section 27, have extremely limited resources, even though they're working on so many matters. I mean, the amount of litigation in this space is enormous, and there's a lot of things that are being fought. I was involved in the that Michael Kumape pit toilet drowning matter in Limpopo, where again, we actually lost that matter in terms of constitutional damages. The courts refused to award anything, but that has actually been taken on appeal. It's going to the Supreme Court of Appeal. We're hoping that they'll reverse that decision now that we have a precedent in La Fiesta de Meni. But there have been numerous other pit toilet deaths since then. And, I mean, I don't know, the statistics are astounding if you look at the number of pit toilets that are still used in places like Limpopo and the Eastern Cape. There's some schools, there's literally thousands that are still in operation. So there's just a breakdown of spending on basic education infrastructure. We were involved in the norovirus outbreak matter at Charlotte Maxeke Hospital, where six children died. We worked for some of the law firms involved there. And then there was an interesting matter that Rosanne was involved in with the South African Social Security Agency against Line of Africa Life Insurance Company, and there, as a result of the work that she did for Black Sash, who joined as a friend of the courts, they no longer allowed to deduct funeral insurance from child support grants. So that was a very important case. Some pro bono tips. It's always good to get a clear brief and state your assignment clearly. It's just normal good housekeeping for actual reports. It's important to have peer review. Luckily, I asked a few senior actuaries such as Gert and Van Linde and Jan Bortke to just read through my reports, see if I missed anything. It's important to get people to have a look at what you've done before you send it out. I communicated with some of the authors of some of the journal papers just to find out more about mortality of psychiatric patients. But it's also important to maintain your independence, just like any other expert witness work. It's easy to get very emotional about a matter like this, where it's just full-scale just the extent of what happened is just unconscionable. So you can get very emotional, but it's better not to. You never assume that that's the job of the advocate. They will take on the case in court. And also, I never thought I'd end up giving testimony in this case because I thought, I've done it for free. Now my work's over. Then you get the call. And then you're on, it's a bit difficult being on giving evidence before 11 cameras and being on TV and all that kind of stuff giving evidence, but luckily I survived it. Just in closing, and I wanted to just quote something that Justice Moseneke said about the former health minister, the former MEC for Health in Gauteng, Kadani Mashlangu. He said the following. He said her overall conduct in relation to the Marathon Project was irrational, inexplicable, highly reckless, and led to the death of at least 144 mental health care users. She acted with impunity, thinking she will get away with murder because the users and their families were vulnerable and poorly resourced. Yesterday, anyone of you attended Jeremy Gardner's session, he mentioned towards the end that hopefully there will be a lot of arrests of political various politicians and corporates involved in corruption. Shortly after the conclusion of the trial, we saw this picture. So we hope it'll start with Kadani Mashlangu. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg. We'll now open for questions. Is there a roving mic? Yeah, up front.
Thanks for the presentation, Greg. I think for me personally, it's a bit of an emotional issue. I read your paper like literally 5 times, even in the plane coming here. Send it almost every colleague that I've seen, even in the party last night, drumming them to read it. So,
thank you.
I think what really strikes me is the Michael Komape issue. I thought about it, and I was personally ready to take it on court appeal, you know, because I see there's a legal prison, a court prison, actually, and it's gonna work. But, you know, sometimes the governments can be extremely funny people. And in your conclusion, there's something you didn't put, which in the paper you put. And I think we need to think a little bit harder about it. And why you said that we need to compensate them to the extent to which the state would have expended whatever cash flows to them. So for that, I think I just want to pause it a little bit and say, fine. But sometimes governments can spend education on me or whatever services on me, which actually might not actually be fair, you know. So if we put that statement and these things become a court precedent going forward, etc., etc., so it means actually governments or the states in future can get away scot-free with certain things, for example. And I think what makes me say this is that in the kind of work that I'm fulfilling these days, in this kind of like spectra, I'm seeing claims actually which are coming back from as far back as apartheid days, for example, you know. And then I was like, so wait a minute. So if, for example, someone is to come today and claim for constitutional damages, and then we use the cash flows, which were, for example, back in the days, 1980, whatever. So if we were to project using those cash flows, actually, that wouldn't be a fair and equitable redress. So in terms of the conclusion that you had in your paper, I'm just saying that's just something that we can think about going forward.
Any further questions or comments? Roseanne?
Thanks, Greg, and thanks for the presentation as well as for representing the profession so well in terms of, I know that you were anxious about how it would be, the input of the profession would be represented at the hearing, and I think you did it really well, so we are all in your debt for that. I guess my point is just about kind of closing the loop, and perhaps as a next step in this. I was actually at the offices of Section 27 a couple of weeks ago, and Sasha was telling me about how they're now assisting the families who have received this compensation, and I think that's another interesting aspect for us to think about in terms of these cases, that, you know, the story has not reached its end yet. And, you know, I was thinking about the opportunity for there to be a difference made to the families in terms of, you know, the education that can pay for and what that means actually to future generations for these families. I mean, it's actually really humbling to think about it that way, but that's a big role that we can play. And I guess I don't know if you've had any engagements with the you know, with the NGOs in terms of who are assisting the families, of how this money is used, and maybe that's something that we need to be thinking about in terms of how we can assist, because financial literacy and so forth is one of the things, but also being sensitive to, you know, what the needs of these vulnerable families are.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I think, like, it's all you can't just sort of, well, you got your million, off you go. Like, you need to manage that money properly. And, yeah, I think a huge amount can be done there still. Nothing's really done at the moment.
Greg? Thanks for listening to you. I've read the reports or the papers before it was used. What struck me when I read through the paper is the systematic way that you addressed the whole issue. And I would advise all actuaries to read the beginning of paragraph 6, Judge Nicholson's comment on actuarial using actuarial calculations. I think it's imperative that all actuaries should read that. Further, also the systematic way where you analyze the various actuarial assumptions, mortality and discount rates, and the way you've used it. I've read it unemotionally, but I know it's an emotional issue, but the systematic way that you've addressed it is the success of this paper. Thank you very much.
Hi, Greg. Thank you so much for the talk. You're really doing incredible work. Just from my side, I wanted to ask how one can get involved as a young member in the Xura profession. I think I'd like to add value.
I think we actually should do some. If you look at other disciplines, such as attorneys have to do 24 hours of pro bono work a year. Why should we be any different? We should be. I mean, we can all afford it, I'm sure, to just give back. And there's various ways you can do it. I mean, you can contact. There's a lot of very good organisations out there, such as probono.org. They actually have offices at the Constitutional Court in Bromfontein. They have regular. They've got various clinics. They run things like housing clinics and. There's so many matters. I've had requests in the past from just matters where disputes around insurance and that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of places where you can help people who really need it.
Thank you. Yes, I echo the thanks to Greg for the excellent work he's done. There's an aspect of this that I've had a similar experience where you as an actuary are working really on the frontier of actuarial work in that grey area between actuarial and legal. And lawyers and judges are tempted to turn around and say, stick to your knitting. You know, this is legal work, this is not actuarial work. But I think quite the opposite. I think you've done the right thing. But I'd like to hear if you have any comments on or can describe, you know, exactly how you trod that very difficult path of saying the profession has something to offer here, but I'm not actually trying to behave as a lawyer because I'm not a lawyer.
So that's a great question, because that was actually the crux of the defence's cross-examination of me. They kept on trying to get me on legal things, and they said to me, well, what's the actual purpose of your report? Why are you here? Why have you calculated funeral expenses? I said, no. Have you calculated a loss of support claim? I said, no. Have you calculated general damages? I said, no. So then they said, well, have you calculated constitutional damages? Which was a very good question. And I didn't answer that I had, I just said I've been asked to do a calculation, which I'm sure will be used in argument. So it is very difficult to get, you know, I think their approach is very good in terms of trying to draw me into, I'm an actuary and I'm saying you should award constitutional damages. All we merely did was just put a number forward, and sometimes the purpose of actuarial evidence is just to plant the seed, and then, you know, obviously he liked the number. In the end.
Thank you. Maybe to Mickey's point, and also to the question before that about getting involved, that I think it is important to recognize that we're part of a team when you're involved in these kind of cases. I mean, in my case, it's often been through the Center for Applied Legal Center for Applied Legal Studies at WITS. And so they approach me, you know, when they need a calculation. And so, you know, our role is obviously brainstorming a little bit with the team in terms of what the approach is. But our role is very much our knitting, which is the finding the number, as opposed to necessarily making the legal argument. So I guess it's important to see it as being part of a team. But I guess to the question of getting involved, I think those kind of legal centres is quite a good place to get involved. But of course, then I would encourage you, if you're a younger member wanting to get involved in these things, then maybe also engage with actuaries who have done this work, you know, so that you can perhaps be involved in a few of their projects, and then, you know, that will help to build your skill set in terms of then being able to assist, so we can kind of learn from each other, because I guess there's the professional promise part of it as well. But I'm really encourage everyone to get involved and give back this way.
Perhaps I just also want to add to that, Greg has also started an incentive for damages actuaries to be involved as assessors to the court. So that would basically be, mean where a judge is not too sure about some of the actuarial issues that are at play. There might be an actuary representing the plaintiff and an actuary representing the defendant, but they are on those respective sides. The court might have a need for independent actuaries to assist them, where there has been a call for damages actuaries. But thinking of it, there might be scope for all actuaries with various sorts of skill sets to be involved in that role. It might be a court case involving a pensions matter or an insurance matter, and the court might have need for independent actuarial advice in that regard. So it might be something we could look at. And I also think that, if I remember correctly, there's a consultant list from ASSA going out every year, and on that list you can tick the box whether you are willing to do pro bono work, and there might be something that comes your way through that route. Yeah, any other questions? Okay, it looks like we can wrap up this session. I want to thank Greg, and I just want to echo some of the sentiments again. I think thank you very much for the good paper that you've written. I would highly recommend everybody go and read that paper. I've personally also already been able to reference that paper in one of my court cases just for the good survey that Greg has done on the net discount rate. Also in the broader context of the pro bono work that you do and the lead that you take in this regard, and thanks from the profession side. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for attending. I've just also got a further admin announcement. We are running late, so what is being done is that all these sessions will be shortened by 5 minutes, the tea break as well. Lunch will be shortened by 10 minutes. So for those of you that want to jot down, I've got the new times for the subsequent sessions. So we'll go into the refreshment break now, and then the next concurrent session will be from 12:05 to 1300. Lunch will then be 1300 to 1350. The next concurrent session will then run from 1350 to 1445. After that, transfer time 1445 to 1455. And closing will then be 1455 to 1555, followed by the Linger Longer session. I do have a written down here as well. I'll leave it here for those of you that want to come and take a photo or something. Thank you very much for attending.